talking to Ned Painter on the 1st of November 1994 in San Diego, California, at home. Okay, we're off, and comes that that all-important first question. How did you first become familiar with and associated with KPFA?
Right. Well, I was news director at KPFA from January 63 to August 64, when, for a combination of reasons, I quit. Burnout being one of them, I think. Because it was an enormously exhilarating job, but also a consuming one. But I worked as a volunteer in the news department for, I suppose, a couple of years while I was at Berkeley getting a master's degree. And I was introduced to KPFA by my dear still friend Peg McCormick, who then was married to Bill Plosser. And Bill was working in the news department at KPFA under Jean Marine, and I can remember my first encounter with these folks. It was at Edie's downstairs, over ice cream and coffee, and I can remember sitting with Peg and Bill and Jean. I think that was it, and I can remember that we were talking about Liebling's book, The Press, which Jean used at KPFA as a kind of an introduction to journalism to news volunteers, and I liked these guys, and they, you know, it was exhilarating company, and so it was then that I, or shortly after, that I began working one day a week as a volunteer. And so I suppose I worked under Gene and under Bill Plosser, and then briefly under John Oliger. And then John quit. And everything came together because I just got my master's at Berkeley. Didn't want at that time to pursue a PhD. In history, American history. And the job became available, and I got it to my great satisfaction, and so that's how it came about. It was through my admiration for, I suppose, Jean Marine and to a lesser extent Bill Plosser. Marine was the star of that operation, and of course he'd done some memorable stuff already, including an interview with Carol Chessman, which in San Quentin, and so that I thought, this is the way I want to go. This is fun. This is rewarding. This is fulfilling.
Yeah. Am I correct that Chessman was not the great international celebrity at this point that he was later to become, or was he already very well known?
Oh, already extremely well known. In fact, he was already dead by then. Governor Brown finally...
No, I mean by the time when the interview was done.
Oh, Gene's interview with him. It was done in the late 50s, after Chessman had written at least two books, I think. So sure. In any case, that's how I got involved with the news scene at KPFA, and it was easily, effortlessly, certainly the best nightly news program in the United States. There was no question about that. And so what a wonderful place in which to work, and to have the run of it yourself, and, you know, to be in charge. So it was an exhilarating time.
What was its general mode of operation?
Well, under Jean Marine, this was, I suppose, a tribute to the guys of astonishing energy, acuity, professionalism, and so on. Generally, they had the AP newspaper wire, not the radio, you know, which was junk. and other sources. And volunteers would come in the morning, I suppose, or the early afternoon, and tear the accumulated AP wire copy and sort it out on a desk. And Marine would come in sometimes as late as 3 in the afternoon and sit down and then after the, you know, working the typewriter like a Thompson machine gun, and go on the air with a half hour of finished copy at 6:30. I was never able to do that. It took me all day.
There were certain distinguished periodicals that you subscribed to as well, didn't you?
For
continuing background.
Oh, I can tell you what we used in addition to the. To the AP newspaper wire, which of course was essential. We subscribed to the Chronicle and the Examiner and the Sacramento Bee, which we got a day late, I think, but invaluable, essential for state politics. The Wall Street Journal, which was occasionally very useful. Christian Science Monitor. The New York Times, which began publishing daily on the West Coast at just about that time. In addition to that, we had The Economist, at the insistence of Elsa Knight Thompson, who, despite her political differences with their slam, thought it the best news magazine in the world, I guess, at least in English.
They had an extremely good American section. Under a woman whose name escapes me at the moment, who ran it for years.
Yeah, The Economist.
Yeah,
yeah. I didn't myself use The Economist that much. Not anyway for nightly news broadcasts. But there was another responsibility of the news director that I sort of inherited from Marine, and that was a weekly backgrounder, a special report which ran 15
right.
minutes. Yes. And Plosser didn't do that, nor did Oliger, but I decided to, because, you know, to indulge my own ego and to make the job more interesting to me and to listeners. And that was supposed to be a backgrounder on some breaking news story. So that required you then to, in addition, to do, you know, considerable sort of haphazard research in order to become an instant expert on in a superficial way about all kinds of stuff, and so that was fun.
This was all text rather than interview.
Yeah. This the special report was simply a script that you would compose that would go for 15 minutes, and you'd do it once a week on any number of things, and it permitted you to dig more deeply into puzzling or interesting or intriguing stories.
Was there generally a single topic for the 15 minutes?
Yeah. Sure. The best one I did was on the Tonkin Gulf episode, because I had at the time, you'll remember, the Tonkin Gulf resolution was passed by Congress unanimously in the House and only with two dissents in the Senate, Ernest Greening of Alaska and Wayne Morris of Oregon. And except for those two, all members of the House and Senate both voted to give Johnson carte blanche to repel aggression in any way he deemed fit. And William Fulbright, who was the floor leader of that, later recanted it and said it was the worst thing he'd ever done. And when he became a critic shortly thereafter of Vietnam policy. But in any case, I had sort of doped things out just by looking at obscure stories from various things, and went on and said that it appeared that the Maddox and the Turner Joy, the two destroyers which were supposedly hit by surprise attacks by North Vietnamese PT boats, had been involved in landing SEAL units in North Vietnam for purposes of sabotage, and that the North Vietnamese knew this. And I did 15 minutes on that and got some interesting responses. as some people denounced me as a traitor, and so they were withdrawing their subscription to KPFA immediately. And
oh my, you know, God. This was response from subscribers then,
not just from
random right wingers.
No. And I also got some calls and letters from enthusiastic supporters who said that was the best damn thing and so on, which was marvelous. And then I did an occasional interview show, you know, with a panel of folks on some topic or another, and that was fun to organize too. So it was just a wonderfully rewarding job. So I would come in early in the morning. You know, I'm no Jean Marine, and I'm no speed reader. Mm-hmm. And so I would come in and take the New York Times down to Edie's and have a cup of coffee and a Danish and go carefully through the Times mm-hmm. in the morning and then go up and rip the wire myself and then work more or less through the day with one or two volunteers, and at 6:30 go on the air with 400 lines of reasonably tight copy. The format was a half-hour nightly news and then 15 minutes on Saturdays and Sundays. There's a certain loyalty, of course, between volunteers and news directors. And so when I took over from Oliger, I had... You always had to do this anyway, keep on training volunteers, because there was a certain turnover. Some volunteers would stay with you for a long time, others would lose interest or be taken away or something. And so weekends were extremely difficult. And so I found myself working 7 days a week, month after month, unable to hand over a Saturday and Sunday to a qualified and responsible and dependable volunteer. I just have to tell you, one time, I thought that this guy was capable of handling the thing and turned it over to him, and I went on my first sort of weekend holiday in many months out to Stinson Beach to see some friends and drink sherry. And then we listened to the news, and to my horror, this guy had sort of fallen in love with the Johannesburg Star, which we also got occasionally. I think they're weekly. And of the 15 minutes, I think he devoted about seven to stories out of South Africa, quoting the Johannesburg Star again and again, and I could see my job going up.
Was that by any chance Joel Mervis's weekly? South African editor who had a daily paper, which was as liberal as he could get away with. I don't remember which one.
Well, the Johannesburg Star was as liberal as it was possible to be under a Dutch apartheid regime.
This was a weekly, did you say?
You know, I'm vague about that. Surely we didn't subscribe to the daily Johannesburg Star, mm-hmm.
because it
was sort of the equivalent of the Manchester mm-hmm. Guardian Weekly.
Because mm-hmm. I know that this guy Joel Mervis had a daily which was a sort of underground liberal paper, no. And then in addition to that he had a weekly under another name, which was pretty open and out front, and. I remember, I had dinner with him in London in 1955, mm-hmm. and in the company of a friend of mine who was the one who actually knew him. But mm-hmm. he had the reputation then of being the most outstanding and courageous and even sometimes foolhardy news editor in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And he went on for some time there afterwards. So I got a feeling that if you had anything from South Africa, it was likely to have been Joel Mervis.
I don't think so. I think it was the Johannesburg Star. As I say,
well, that may have been the name of it.
Well, the Johannesburg Star is a big paper. You know, it's like the Rand Daily Mail or something. It's I guess it's the probably the English language South African newspaper, which is a perennial leader in circulation. It's in any case, the point of the story was that this guy, quite innocently, was sabotaging me. And I think at the time, too, I later heard that Elsa Knight Thompson, the public affairs director, was unhappy with me was rather monitoring my performance. And so I was in a vulnerable situation, and God, so there it was. I couldn't rely on a trained volunteer really to take over very often. Of course, the one great exception is Hannah Pitkin, who had been working there for years and was a friend, as we know, of Marine. Hannah, you could almost sort of just turn the operation over to her every Thursday, knowing that it was going to be fine. So it was a time-consuming job. I would be in there, I suppose, 70 hours a week sometimes. And I think that's why I only lasted for 18 months or 19 months or whatever it was.
you did at one point during that write, it may not have been a special report, but it was some kind of report which went on the air, which was a report to the listeners, of how KPFA went about presenting the news and what the nature of the operation was.
I don't even remember that one.
Well, I'll have to show you a copy of it.
Okay.
Because it was one of the documents which Vera Hopkins selected for inclusion in her Pacifica sampler, that great collection of 450 pages of documents of KPFA from the beginning to 1987.
I'll be damned.
And there you are. And it was a sort of a...
You kept this a surprise for me until just now, or you just recalled it.
I've kept it a surprise for you just now. The Great Thurber Cartoon. Perhaps this will refresh your memory. The hippopotamus.
Yes.
But it started with you. It was a kind of a memoir about the news as well as a current report and a personal report. And you started off by talking about driving across the bay and listening to a news broadcast from one of the commercial stations, and noting something egregious about it, and feeling that's not the sort of thing of which we would be guilty on KPFA, and then went on to explain why.
I'd love to read this thing to see
I'll show it to you. Well, your feelings must be comparable to mine in looking at the index of the archive down at KPFK, the Pacifica Archives, and finding two or three programs by myself in there that I cannot remember having produced. But there we are. That's the wonderful thing about déjà vu.
Yes.
You also had association with the station. You continued to do some volunteer work after you quit, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, for several years. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Why did I quit? Because it was such a consuming job, I suppose. Another thing was that... why did I go back to graduate school and get a PhD in history at Berkeley? I had wanted to be a journalist. And while I was at KPFA, I applied for an Alicia Patterson Fellowship, and my idea was that I would go to Columbia University and study economic development under Alberto Hirschman and take Spanish, because I was very much interested in Latin America at the time. The Alliance for Progress, the military coup against Jean Goulart in Brazil, assisted by the United States in 1964, all of that sort of thing. And I thought, this is where I want to go. This is what I want to write about. But I didn't get the Elisha Patterson Fellowship. And so where did you go after being at KPFA? I suppose you went into radio or TV journalism, but after KPFA, it would have been a living death to go to some commercial station. And so I went back to history, stepped back from this focus on the present don't regret having done so. I left after assuring more or less that Scott would get the job. And the other candidate for it, I don't know if anybody else remembers this, was Bob Scheer.
Robert Scheer,
yes.
Yeah, who went on to run for something or other in Berkeley.
Congress against Jeffrey Cohalen and challenged him and almost won. And then 2 years later, Cohalen was defeated by the current representative.
And one of the prominent volunteers on the Bob Scheer campaign was Alice Waters of Chez Panisse.
Is that
later,
right?
Yep.
Well, Ned Peter, curiously enough, was too. I got to remember going around door to door and remember what's a black lady saying, oh, yeah, I'm for Bob Scheer, you know. He's a hometown boy, you know. And I said, oh, yeah, I know that. But, of course, anyway, Bob Scheer later went on to Los Angeles Times, and I don't know that he's ever won a Pulitzer, but he's now a much published and a columnist for the Times and syndicated, I suppose. So he was a very formidable guy, but, Scott was not only my friend, but somebody who had worked like hell at KPFA and was fully deserving of getting the job, and knew it better than Scheer ever would, I think. So I don't feel any qualms about that.
There was a book that came out about the Scheer campaign. You probably saw.
No, I didn't.
It was a picture and text book of about. Typewriter page size rather than octavo quarto, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Sub coffee table size, but I have a copy of it.
Well,
which I bought in London. So what is there anything that comes to your mind that you were any particular events or projects that you remember being associated with as a volunteer after your news directorship?
Well, let's see. How long did I work as a volunteer? During all of Scott's tenure, I think, which ended when he did win an Elisha Patterson Fellowship.
I was too polite to mention.
Yes. I think that's when my association with KPFA ended. About then, not because Scott had left, but simply because I was starting on my dissertation, and it was all-consuming. That would have been about 67. So I think I continued there for 3 years. The only thing memorable I can think of at the moment was something that we broadcast that was considered to be in poor taste by most people. it was a satire in the
bombing of Watts.
Yeah, the bombing of Watts, which I have a copy of somewhere.
Which you sent me a copy of years ago,
yes.
And which, of course, I still have.
Yes, right.
which I believe is in the archives, the Pacifica Archives.
Oh, no kidding. Anyway, I thought that was great fun, and we fell all over ourselves laughing while we were doing it and had to do sort of take after take to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I can't think of anything serious or dramatic. That
one of those things which at the time is in totally outrageously bad taste, and which if listened to now might possibly be even mistaken for history.
Yes, yes. Well, I didn't think it was in bad taste. I thought it was just fun and inspired. One of the best things I've ever done, really.
Scott's voice is on that, isn't he?
I
remember him
being
one of the...
Yeah, he played Eric Greyhead, which was, you know... And I did LBJ. but no, I can't think of anything dramatic. I think the only thing to be said, really, about the period of my tenure as news director is that the two big stories were civil rights in Vietnam, and you know both of them were growing, but we were paying a lot closer attention to Vietnam than virtually anybody else was, I think. And people who would say you're my only source of news would always disturb me. I think what idiots, you know, to rely on a single source. But nevertheless, if there was one source on Vietnam that was worth paying attention to, I think it was ours. Well, of course, this is all gathering in stuff from the Associated Press, Christian Science Monitor, and.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So on and so
using KPFA
together.
As a single source was, in fact, using an extremely multiple source.
Yes, yes, I will say that. But then, of course, it was all ultimately up to the judgment of one editor, writer, me, during my tenure.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this
and
was,
I wouldn't trust anybody.
On the other hand, this was at a time in Pacifica's history where the presentation of an extremely broad range of opinion was a matter of deep principle, and there were no commercial restraints upon what one said. Nothing was left out because you knew that your boss was going to come down on you like a ton of bricks if you said something that hurt his company or something of that sort.
So right.
As only sources go, it was a pretty damn good only source.
Although, acknowledgedly, left. Which isn't to say I tried to skew the news or anything of the sort. Of course I didn't. I tried to be as impartial and skeptical as I could. It's just that being impartial and skeptical and not having a pro-American bias particularly, your reporting came out, to be...
Within the American context, that was in itself defined as a left-wing bias.
Sure, sure. But there was... this was, after all, liberal Berkeley and the Bay Area, and most of our listeners, I'm sure, were liberals themselves, and conservatives regarded us and the University of California both as sources of possibly commie propaganda. Mm-hmm. You remember Lucius Beebe, who called Berkeley the little red schoolhouse across the bay. I can remember that that Elsa Knight Thompson.
Well, after all, in Berkeley, they didn't dress for dinner.
Yes, Elsa Knight Thompson. You remember that she had a rota, as she called it, a roster of commentators, doing 15 minutes a week, and was always frustrated by the fact that. Conservatives and even centrists often would have nothing to do with this because it sort of would have compromised the reputations, I suppose, to go on there. And so most of the commentary did tend to be left, although not everybody. Caspar Weinberger, you remember, was a stout supporter. Good evening, this is Caspar Weinberger with your regular Republican commentary.
Yes.
You remember that?
Yeah. In the days when he could legitimately be described as a liberal Republican, and he used to do a sort of a guest show for KQED as well, in which
yes.
he was, Dick Moore, who knew him very well over at KQED, said that one of his saddest memories of his life was observing Cap Weinberger being gradually converted from a decent, fair-minded human being into a glassy-eyed apparatchik for the Nixon administration.
Yeah. And but I think on Elsa's rota of commentators, he sort of stood out like a sore thumb. And in a way, I guess he was our defense against the accusation that everything out of that station was knee-jerk left.
There was a while, at least, and maybe it was before this, when William Buckley was broadcasting out of New York and was on the air.
Out of BAI?
Yeah.
Really?
And it pulled out, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He didn't stick it very long. But I remember well Ayn Rand on regularly.
Again out of BAI?
Yeah, when I was there.
Huh. I never heard her on KPFA. I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, she was there. I don't think it was regular in the sense that it was, you know, a slot every week or anything like that.
Yeah.
But she did... she did go into the commentary slot of time.
Yeah.
And on a number of occasions, at least, I remember.
I can remember one guy, not this is furthering this interview in any way, but I can remember one guy that I listened to regularly and with interest and sympathy, and that was Father Eugene Boyle. Do you remember?
Oh, yes.
A Jesuit.
Yes.
Out of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And... you know, very thoughtful and kind and humane Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice to have him on there.
In fact, that does further the interview indeed, because one of the things that I'm interested in is personal responses, reminiscences, even anecdotes, because this is, after all, going to be a popular history,
mm-hmm.
rather than just a source of dates and facts and information. It's not intended as a ground of research material for somebody else to write a book out.
Yes.
So anything that occurs to you in the way of personal reminiscence,
sure.
is more than welcome.
Okay, one does right now. This was, I suppose, it was in 65, it had to have been, and so I was, again, a news volunteer at that time under Scott, but we had a young news volunteer, a kid from Toronto named Jeff Rose, and for some reason the word curd came to be hilarious to us. I can't remember what it was. We had all these jokes about Kurds.
Mm-hmm. Like the Kurds have a way of their own. There's one for you.
Anyway, Jeff and I went on the air with a nightly half-hour newscast, and Kurds got into a couple of stories, and we were stifling laughter, and hitting the cough button, to get through it. And right after a story on the Kurds, there was a story out of the Dominican in the aftermath of the American invasion, to suppress Juan Bosch and liberalism in the Dominican Republic. And it was about the discovery of some 15 corpses found in a shallow grave, the victims of state execution. And Jeff, I was reading the story, and Jeff, sort of a hangover from the last Kurd story, began to giggle, and it got to me, and I had to suppress the cough switch. And came back trying to read straight this horrible story about 15 corpses found in a shallow grave, and my voice was going like that.
The newsreader was obviously so visibly moved by this story that he had to suppress his sobs.
It was a horrible moment, you know, to try to suppress this laughter from just coming out over the story of...
I'm sorry, I can't go on.
So that sort of thing occasionally happened to you, but I never completely blew it.
if you do have any abiding impressions of the interrelationships between KPFA and the Berkeley community and how they may have influenced each other, they would be welcome.
Okay, well, perhaps this is a way of getting at that. The division between public affairs and news. Elsinore Thompson, the public affairs director, had of course been around there for a long, long time, and she was a lady of immense experience. She was extremely skeptical of the usefulness relevancy of a nightly news broadcast.
Oh, was she indeed?
Oh, yes. And this goes back to Jean Marine's tenure. She would refer to Jean and Bill Plosser as playing gentlemen of the press. She felt, I think, that her operation was enormously more important than ours, because she was involved particularly with civil rights coverage. In fact, public affairs was virtually a program on civil rights under Elsa and Burton White, to the exclusion, I thought, of other, perhaps less noteworthy developments, but nevertheless, things that deserve some attention. She didn't think so, and so I think her feeling was that the news was unnecessary, I think she particularly felt that way during my first months as news director.
One feeling perhaps feeding the other.
And so I got signals. I got the message. I knew my position was a little more precarious than it might seem, that Elsa was not on my side. I can't remember now what it was that it turned her around. I think it was, in fact, only her dismissal by Trevor Thomas and the rallying around of the staff, including me, to save her job, that quite changed her mind about my character worthiness to hold that job. And thereafter, in the last several months I was news director, I suppose I had no firmer supporter than Elsa.
There were still several months that you were there after the firing and the reinstatement.
Yes. That was in the spring of '64, early spring, mm-hmm. I think.
Because if I remember correctly, and what you and Scott said that virtually on the day, I'm thinking of another thing. It was the shooting of Kennedy that you took off on a holiday.
At that time, that was in November, and I'd been working for 11 months, and I was burned out and desperately needed a break. And my dad's birthday was on the 22nd, as was coincidentally my nephew's first birthday. Both of them came on the 22nd of November. And so weeks before, I had arranged with Scott that he would take over for a week and I'd get away to San Diego. And I had a flight out of Oakland at 2 or 2:30 that afternoon, and it was about 10 o'clock or 10:30 a.m. when there were four bells from the AP ticker, and I saw the first lead that the president had been shot in a motorcade in Dallas and had been rushed to this hospital. Went on the air with that, And then we went back to regular programming, I suppose, whatever it was. And then I went on the air again, I think about noon, to give a more extensive thing. And then I think I simply advise listeners that both NBC and CBS were providing continuous coverage, you know, in case anybody didn't know it. But I felt that that I was, you know, betraying the station and my own responsibility as a news director in a way, to get away, although I desperately wanted to. And I think particularly because of the assassination, I was overwhelmed by it, as, you know, most people were. And Scott just said, get out of here, you know. Get on that plane. Leave it to me.
Yeah, well, if you had to leave it to somebody, he was a good man to leave it to.
He sure as hell was. And so, you know, the greatest, in terms of dimensions, event, horrible, of course, that occurred during my tenure. I wasn't there to cover. I was at home in San Diego watching television with my sister and parents.
Yeah. Now, the strike, the 63 strike, which has been which has been documented in such detail by Vera Hopkins.
It was early 64, wasn't it? I think so.
I think it was 63. Yeah.
Okay.
Was it? Wait a minute. Maybe. 63 was the CIS hearings and the renewal of the license.
Yeah.
And then that slopped over. Yes. Yeah. It probably was 64. Anyway, I've got that. When it comes to dates and stuff, I've got that all down accurately somewhere. Yeah. But the accepted version of the strike was that it took place as a result of, as virtually a sole cause, the firing of Elsa Knight Thompson. My memory, and checking this out with Scott, he remembers it the same, that the firing of Elsa was more in the nature of a fuse exploding an already existing powder keg than being the powder keg itself, and that the formation of the Union in the first place grew out of bitter response to Pacifica's response to the calling before the SISS committee and the cooperation with the committee, which started to drive a wedge down through the staff, and that wedge went on as certain people from certain program producers came into the station working directly under Trevor rather than under department heads, and that the authority of department heads was impinged upon and gradually being eroded, and that it was that this was the that this was the motivation for the effort to organize the station and to bring union into it, and that then, in the midst of this exploration, a firm intention that was being carried out, that the firing of Elsa is suddenly a bomb dropped into the middle of this already potentially explosive situation, and that it served as a convenient rallying point for feelings that were already, in existence.
Yeah. That may be true. It wasn't for me. Let's see how to approach this. The place was a place of raging egos in some way. in some ways, and particularly Elsa's. I tended to steer clear of factionalism and so on. I wasn't interested in it. I wasn't interested in intrastation strife and partisanship and egos and the rest of it. And I wasn't. I wasn't around when the political divisions. Jerry Shore, Three Women of Courage, and all that stuff developed. I simply wasn't involved with that, and so I was something of an onlooker, I think, and I was interested in my news operation. That was enough for me, and so in my case, anyway, the dismissal of Elsa was the cause, as I saw it. I felt sympathy for Trevor Thomas, who was a damn decent guy. But in this case, he'd done something not at all decent. And I could understand something of his frustration and his impatience with Elsa.
More than that, he was scared shitless of her.
Oh, yeah, sure. A damn difficult woman under the best of circumstances. And my feeling was simply, Elsa does define public affairs rather narrowly, there are other faults one might find with the operation, but you don't treat somebody like that, particularly somebody who has earned the respect through hard work and courage for so long. And the dismissal of Elsa seemed to me it seemed to me that it established the need for a union. That's all. And mm-hmm. So for me, that was the issue, that there had to be some sort of, tenure and that the livelihood and careers of people ought not to be put at the whim of a station manager, and so that we needed a union. So for me, that was the thing that motivated me.
Right. Okay. That fits neatly into the context of other people that I've talked to about this and of what I want to do with that period.
We all bring our own individual perspectives and experiences to bear.
Which is what I want to do. In the course of telling this.
Yeah.
I long ago gave up any incentive to write this from my own viewpoint.
Yeah.
And in fact, I don't know if I told you, I had a very useful and cordial interview with Ernest Lowe. Do you remember Ernest Lowe?
No, I don't.
Ernest Lowe was one of the principal representatives of the anti-strike contingent in the station.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was his position? I don't remember Ernest Lowe.
He was one of those who became an independent program producer, reporting directly to Trevor.
Ah, I see. Yes.
And in an area which particularly stepped upon the toes of Elsa, because he was working in areas such as reports on the migrant sharecroppers in the San Joaquin and the Sacramento valleys.
Well, I think my feeling about the entire thing was always mixed. I thought that Trevor's firing of Elsa proved the need for a union. At the same time, I had misgivings about NABET, National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, AFL-CIO. Although I liked that that little Irishman who was the organizer, I can't remember his name.
Bob Lenihan.
Lenihan, yeah. I liked him very much. But I did feel
his
that
boss
it was
didn't like him much.
I did feel
bringing this bunch of troublemakers in.
I did think it was unfortunate. You know, that the need for an employee organization had been demonstrated. Mm-hmm. You know, too bad that it, you know, that things couldn't be settled, quote, within the family.
Yeah.
You know?
And I was told
and it
by,
turned out we weren't such a happy little family.
Yeah.
And I really felt badly about all of the ill feeling that resulted from the strike. And I can remember, you know, the Thomas Loyalists, largely the secretaries around there, and how they just hated us for doing all this to poor Trevor. And the way in which, of course, it divided the whole Pacifica community of subscribers and supporters, and mm-hmm. you know, with each side out there meeting with community folks and giving its side to it. It was all a mess, rather, wasn't it?
Yeah. Reading Elsa's account of that period recently, I fell about laughing at one point. At one point in her chronology. On a particular date, on a particular afternoon, the entry is that Al Bendick and Will Ogden went to Trevor's house and grilled him for 5 hours. The thought of Will Ogden grilling someone for 5 hours reminds me of somebody's report of an attack of Howe in Parliament upon Maggie Thatcher as equivalent to being savaged by a dead hamster. I'm not putting down Will because it was a delightful, a wonderful
guy.
No,
but I can't imagine him
such
grilling somebody.
Yeah, I mean, his approach was so nonviolent.
Oh, yes.
In every possible way.
Gracious, respectful, yes. Gentle.
Yeah.
I can't imagine Al Bendick particularly grilling either. Mm-hmm. It's easier to imagine him doing so than Will Ogden.
Yes, well, he's a bit more frightening if one were on the other side, a man of considerable legal experience.
How long did the union last there, or is it still there, or what?
It was finally disbanded by vote in 1972.
Uh-huh.
I think Al Silbowitz told me about this. Because what happened was that the union gradually degenerated into a platform for Dana Caddon, Bob Bergstresser, and Joe Agos. Mm. And that all of the program people by this time were well sick of it, and that these people were continually making trouble, you know, everybody wanted shot of it, and they were finally able to deregister, whatever the term
de-certify,
is.
Decertify.
Decertify. That
yes.
was it. The union, and those three were also mm-hmm. dismissed at the same time.
Well, I think all of that might have been anticipated anyway. I mean, my feeling was, too bad we have to do this, damn it, and because I don't think it's going to contribute to the long term health of this organization.
It was
essential at the moment.
It was analogous in a metaphorical sort of way to Lou Hill's growing reliance upon cortisone, the cure, which proved to be worse than the disease.
Yeah. Well, look, John, I haven't come up with anything brilliant or illuminating particularly. Shall we stop this for the moment?
Yeah, okay, fine.
Right. Okay. John, you suggested earlier that I might try to put KPFA somehow into a broader context, what the station meant to American culture or the American experience in the 50s and 60s. That seemed to me a tall order. I was a toiler in the vineyards, I suppose.
It's a tall order is an order one makes of a tall person.
Well, you came to the right man, obviously. Anyway, through my time at KPFA, I was, of course, focused upon the news operation and sort of keeping my nose above the water and succeeding at that. And so I don't know about reflecting about, putting it into a broader context, but let me try. And I thought the way to do it would be not from the point of view of somebody who worked there so much as somebody who was bowled over by listening to the station. When I arrived at Berkeley, I was from San Diego, and FM radio meant simply classics to me, nothing much more. AM radio was, of course, a top 40 desert. And then there were the networks, and CBS Radio News was still pretty good, but, marginal kind of operation. And then I had the experience of British broadcasting, because I went to Oxford in 60 and 61, and I'd never heard anything like it, a third program. I can remember... for example, a documentary on the herring fishers and the...
Singing the Fishing.
Up jumped the herring, the king of the sea.
Produced by Charles Parker with
something
music by
right,
Peggy
you'll
Seale
never catch me.
Seeger and Ewan McCall.
In this windy old weather, this stormy old weather, when the wind blows, we shall all go together. I can remember Ewan McCall singing that, and I only heard the documentary once, And then I can remember them doing Nathaniel Gillespie's Miss Lonely Hearts.
You didn't hear it on KPFA.
No, I heard it on BBC, third
because
program.
Because it was broadcast on KPFA.
Uh-huh.
And I have the transcription.
Anyway, and then an intelligent discussion of Tennyson and Stockhausen music and so on. Marvelous stuff. And then I came up to Berkeley as a graduate student in the fall of 61. And encountered KPFA, and I didn't know that there was anything like it. I didn't remotely suspect that there could be anything like it on American radio, with things like Philip Elwood's jazz programs and Oliger's "Sing Me a Song of Social Significance." And I now remember Ed Cray had a program of blues music. That's what it was. A taped broadcast of a lecture on the state of American fiction by Saul Bellow, and contemporary music, and opera, and on.
When did you hear the Saul Bellow talk?
It must have been in 61, because I was living on Amador in North Berkeley, and it was my first year.
I was just wondering, because I later taped another talk by Saul Bellow on the state of American fiction at the American Embassy in London, which I sent back. But that wasn't until 66.
Yeah. No, this was at Berkeley. It must have been 61. Anyway, I'd never encountered anything like it, or as I say, imagined anything like it was possible on American radio. Now, as to putting your original question, putting it into the context, I'm kind of addled, John. I don't know how to answer that. Obviously, it was terribly important, and it was terribly important in sustaining, I think, the civil rights movement, which is what speaks to me, because that's what was going on at the time. And of course, Elsa's role in that was, Elsa Knight Thompson's was absolutely central. She was indefatigable. She and Bert White, and I can remember them working late often. I think I also probably put in far longer days than anybody else who worked there. I mean, it was her life, and I can remember her sitting in public affairs, editing tapes and listening to them, you know, late into the evening, to get it right. And so for the broader community, KPFA was, of course, an indispensable resource. But I don't know that I've got anything wise to say about it.
Right. Well, if anything else occurs to you,
okay,
out comes the machine again.
All right.